The Sunstone Foundation presents Mormon Women Speak, Suggestions for Change, recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium, held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We take you now to the University of Utah campus where the program is about to begin.
I appreciate this opportunity to do this. It was a chance for me to sort of sort through my own feelings about concrete changes in the church and the feelings that I have about the church as a very involved and active member of my ward, working in the primary and with the young women over the last couple of years. I've entitled my little segment, because I feel I have to have a title to start thinking about things, Sex, Fun, and the Cub Scouts. And I put sex first, even though I'm really going to talk about it last, because it sort of, you know, is titillating. But if I put it last, like most women do, we will postpone that element of the talk until the end for the most fun for all of us. I'm going to structure my little remarks around three rather banal stories that have to do with sex, fun, and the Cub Scouts. And they're banal stories, I call them that, because they're stories that we've all probably heard in one version or another, having to do with the role of the female in the church, and particularly I'm going to talk about young females, meaning girls primary age and young women age. And I tell you these stories partly because most of us will probably share a version of them, and partly because it's sort of outrageous that these stories can be told as current stories. But I don't tell them only to provoke outrage, but sort of to show you that there is an uneven progress being made in the church and in attitudes of members of the church about women. This unevenness means that in some places, some of these stories might not happen anymore. But with the change of a bishop or the change of a young women president or a young men president, they might happen again. So progress in these issues is not always made in easily measurable ways. I want to tell these stories so that you can see that and also see where the room for change is, and also so that you can know that I recognize that these may not be typical of every place in the church. And also to say that even though we say the more things change, the more they stay the same. I mean, you see progress and then you see backsliding. Even so, the more things change, the more things change. They may seem to stay the same, but there is change afoot, I hope, anyway. The issues that I want to address are issues of parity, of equality, of treatment of women and men and girls and boys in the church, but also issues of orientation and focus, the way that we focus our attention on women and men in the church. The first of my banal stories has to do with Cub Scouts. And they're personal stories, so you'll have to bear with that. I have a son who this January turned 8 years old and so was immediately enrolled in the Cub Scouts. We went out and bought him his shirt and all of the numbers and the badges and a hat and a neckerchief and a necker slide and a belt and God knows what all. And the first activity that we went to was a blue and gold dinner. I don't know how many of you have kids that have been or are involved in the Cub Scouts, but this was quite an affair. This involved boys and their dads baking cakes and decorating them in outlandish fashions. It involved, you know, a huge potluck dinner. It involved awards being given to the boys and ritual shouts and chants and so on. It was a very exciting occasion. Now, this is not my sort of thing, but I have a kid who, you know, is going to get the chance to see if it's his kind of thing. It was his dad's kind of thing. So there we all are at the blue and gold dinner. The whole family is there, 3 daughters and 2 sons, 1 daughter older. And I realized as we sat there at this blue and gold dinner that whether or not it was my kind of thing, it was, you know, very exciting, involving. It involved honoring the boys. It involved watching and turning our attention toward their achievements. And I realized that in my daughter's 10 years in the church that she had never had cumulatively that much attention paid to her achievements and honors as my son was getting in one night of Cub Scouts. Now, this, as you can see, is an issue of parity, okay? But it's also an issue of orientation. Somewhere along the line, and I don't know who to affix the praise or blame to, someone decided that Cub Scouts and scouting in general was an important thing for the church to be involved in. Now, whether or not that's true is another question for another day. But I would submit that one concrete change that could be made in the institutional church is that if there's going to be an organized system of achievement, activity, and honor for boys from the age of 8 until the age of 18, there ought to be a similar system for girls. Period. I will add as a footnote to this banal story that I am now a den leader. Okay. The second story has to do with fun. And this is a more distant story since it comes from my own days as a young woman. My father was the explorer leader in our ward. And for one of the fun summer activities that they planned for boys, and I will tell you several of the fun summer activities because they were truly astonishing. One of the things that was most astonishing is that the leaders would care to involve themselves in these activities. But the boys and their dads bought kits to make canoes. They all made canoes. And I mean literally all of them made canoes. And this was like, you know, at least 25 boys made canoes. And their dads and the boys took a river trip down the Colorado River. Meanwhile, well, the girls were doing things like learning how to apply makeup and learning about being good wives and so on. The boys also took a bike trip in Hawaii. Now, this is an issue. I came from a rich ward, as you can probably tell. but this was the thing that's disturbing to me now, especially. I don't know that it disturbed me as much then, but it disturbs me now, that it would be considered so important for boys to have that kind of serious fun and not for girls. Now, having served in the Young Women program recently in my wards and stake, I can tell you that that kind of serious fun is not encouraged for girls now either, at least wasn't in my stake. Moreover, the revision of the Young Women program recently, which is a revision that entails a new system of achievements and goal setting, encourages girls again to focus not on that kind of achievement, that kind of fun or activity or adventure, but on much more interior things. For instance, the Young Women's program is structured around 7 spiritual values. None of them could remotely be construed as adventurous. Even the value of knowledge, for instance, in their new achievement book, is some of the values experiences that are encouraged are things like memorizing scriptures and reading church books and so on. Now, I realize, and I'm sure you realize too, that the church cannot be everything to everyone. It can't be the source of all fun and activity and adventure for every kid. But I would submit to you again that if there is going to be a system, and much of this again comes through the scouting program in our church, whereby boys are encouraged to have adventure and the kind of serious fun that you remember and that indeed shapes personalities and concepts of selves, that there ought to be a similar system for girls. And I think that's really important for us to make a distinction between the kind of spiritual teaching that girls are getting now, which I think in many ways is good, and the kind of fun that I'm proposing. I think it's important, and obviously it's going to be the role of a ecclesiastical institution to promote certain kinds of spiritual values. I have no beef with that. I have no beef with the church wanting to raise and train teenage girls to be good women. The problem is that if they're not also encouraged to find out what they like to do and pursue those things, in an ecclesiastical setting, and I'll talk about that a little more in a moment, they learn to turn away from their own impulses and desires. And I think that that's one of the most important things for the church to teach, and this is the most important revision that I would say and concrete change that needs to be made, which is that from the very beginning, girls need to be taught that they too have desire, that they too are desiring subjects, that they too have wants and needs that they should act upon, that they should actively pursue. I think that if girls know that they are desiring subjects, that issue, that thought, that value is prior to the subject of managing desire, which is what we really more teach girls, how to manage desire, in particular the desire of young men, which leads me to sex. Okay. Now, the last banal story is the most probably outrageous of all, but I will tell it. It'll shock you. Probably not, actually. This is a story that involves the teaching of sex and an object lesson, and I bet you can imagine some of them and remember some of the ones that you heard when you were a kid. This one was one that I had never seen before, but it was at a young men, young women fireside. Our bishop was very concerned with the problem of moral transgressions among the young people in our ward. And so he decided that he would have a special fireside where he gave frank talk, down and dirty, about sex. And it was down and dirty, and it was frank. But he began it by an object lesson, which involved a donut. And I'll tell you what he did with this donut. He had a young man of priest age and a young woman of laurel age stand up, and he handed the donut to the young man and told him to, yes, it's going to be graphic, lick the glaze off of the donut. Meanwhile, he turned the attention of the group to the young woman and said, you know, Carrie is a young, beautiful woman. She dresses nicely. Carrie, why do you do that? She said, well, I dress nicely because I like to dress this way. I like to feel good about myself, and so on. Then he turns back to the young man and said, he said, now give me back that donut, you know, not really touching it. And then he handed it to another young man in the group and said, would you like to eat this donut? Okay, well, it is. It's a shocking and an outrageous story, and it's one of those things that I had hoped had disappeared, but of course it hasn't. This is what I mean by the uneven development of change in the church and in any institution. What that promotes, of course, is the vision or the image of men as consumers, as people who are hungry and need to be satisfied, and the people who are desirers and who know what is desirable. Okay? Young women, on the other hand, are the object of consumption. They are food to be eaten. They are those who are desired and who can become less desirable if they circulate. Okay? That's a pretty important and vivid lesson to present to young people about sex. What I would say about that, and this is probably the most abstract of my concrete changes, is we need to change the way that we teach our young people about sex. And I think sex is not only sex. It's never only sex, right? It's about the way we value ourselves. It's about the way we understand our own desires and understand the desire of others, the way we understand reciprocal desire. If we teach kids about sex in this way, and I would say even if we don't use those object lessons, that's the way we're teaching girls about desire, that they in fact are not desiring people, that they are desirable. If we teach that way, then what we teach women to do is to defer the question of their own desire, indeed to sublimate it or even to bury it, and to project all desire and thus, you know, all activity onto the male. Now, you may say that this does not happen to you. You don't feel this way. Maybe your daughters don't feel that way about themselves. I would say to you that even if you've taught it differently in your family, and I don't know if I'm talking to people who have teenage girls or not, that sort of ideological fabric surrounds everyone in the church. Even if you've been taught differently, that's there too. Those things may clash. And your kids may have different values, or the kids that you know may have different values. But when those things clash, they have to deal with that ideological fabric that says women are desirable, men are desiring, men desire. And the problem with that is if you leave blank the space where women, where women's desire should be, then women learn not to take their own desire seriously. And I think the foundation of any personality and the foundation of any spirituality must be that we all have desire, and that there are all kinds of desire, and that we must manage our desire appropriately. And that, of course, leads to, that has to do with desire for God, desire for a relationship with God as well. Again, this is an issue of parity and orientation. Men and women both desire. Girls and boys should both be taught that. But it's also an issue of orientation, because so much of what I see as the problem for young women and girls in the church is that our attention is turned to men, their achievements, their power, their exercise of that power, and so on. I would say that if we start to teach girls that they also are desiring, that they desire, that they want things, and that to value and act upon that desire and learn to manage that desire, then many great changes could happen. I won't say that they will happen or what they would be, but a lot of things could happen. For instance, women could speak more in church if they learned that what they had to say and what they thought was important and as valid as what men say. There are a number of other cosmetic changes that I'm sure you've thought of, things like young women should be called on missions at the same age as young men. I think our lesson manuals for the young women, and indeed in primary, need to be revised to reflect gender balance for primary kids and to reflect a more active feminine spirituality in the young women's lessons. But I want to say that even if these changes might seem cosmetic, that the cosmetic is almost always less superficial than we think. It seems like it goes both ways. When you make a cosmetic change, you can say, all that does is delay the moment when radical change needs to happen. But I think also that cosmetic change, the change in the way things look and seem in the church, things as simple, for instance, as women being able to pray in sacrament meeting, begins to affect attitude, which, of course, is the most radical and deep change of all.
When Anne asked me to join her panel, she asked if I would give you the single woman's perspective, and my first thought was, I'm so tired of being the single woman and giving the single woman's perspective, you know, the donut that's still on the shelf and unlicked and fresh. But then I started thinking about the single woman's perspective, and I decided that there were some things I wanted to share with you. Anne first posed this in one of her correspondences with me as a wish list for women. And so I decided if President Benson was Santa Claus, and I could sit on his knee, which is a tantalizing picture, I would wish for these things for single Mormon women. First of all, I would wish that the church would stop teaching its women dependence. That only works when you have someone to depend on. Many single women that I know have wasted years in a form of spiritual paralysis because they were not taught or trained to take risks or expose themselves to a little bit of adventure. And the same is true for married women who ended up with someone who was not dependable, and that's very frequently the case. I wish that single and married women in the church would bury the hatchet and not in one another. I sense a real rivalry sometimes between the single and married women in the church, each trying to prove to the other that their state is the preferred one. You married women, you know, when you're pregnant, you kind of trotted around, and you love to dress the kids all in the same outfit that you're wearing and bring them in just about 5 minutes late so we can all see them walk up the aisle with their little bows in their hair. And And then you put your arm around your husband in sacrament meeting and scratch his back. Well, we single women, we have our weapons too. You're taking the kids to Disneyland for summer vacation. Gee, I wish I could do that, but I'm meeting Raul on the Riviera. Or, gee, I'd love to come to your family home evening on Monday night, but I'm hosting a dinner for the Sultan of Brunei. I'm not available. We each try to prove that our state is a superior one. I wish that the church, in its curriculum and practice, would stop treating single women as the eternal child. Marriage is somehow, it has taken on in our church society, and perhaps not just the church but outside too, this rite of passage that it really doesn't deserve, as though the day after your wedding you're suddenly mature. And I frequently feel that younger married women in the church are given more deference and credibility than myself because I haven't crossed that threshold or been carried across it. I wish that the church would do a better job of preparing single women to enter the temple. Temple covenants, unfortunately, have become linked to male and female rites of passage. For men, they take out their temple endowments when they go on a mission, and accept Melchizedek priesthood, and usually that's at the point where they go on a mission. And for women, it is either when they get married, or if that lingers too long, when they decide to go on a mission themselves, or when they've given up on both. The decision rarely has to do with a readiness to covenant. For most people, it's a decision of what wedding venue. Are we going to get married in the temple or somewhere else, like choosing the flavor of the cake and the photographer? And to me, that I wish the church would prepare women to make a covenant that's independent of marriage or mission or any other rite of passage. And if I may be so bold, I wish that the temple ceremony would be changed to recognize the spiritual needs of those who have no one to call them forth from the grave. We single women spend all of our lives waiting to be called or chosen. Many are called, few are chosen, some are neither. And it's depressing to think that you might spend eternity waiting to be called forth. And maybe if your dad forgets to come for you, you're in trouble. I wish that wards would fellowship single women as eagerly as they do mothers of five. We're often not perceived as the same resource as a married woman. We're not Relief Society president material for some reason, or we're not primary president material. And even worse, once you get past about 30, people will assume, and probably for good reason, that you're only going to be marginally active because many singles do leave the church at about that point in their life. And so single women have to prove themselves each time they move to a new ward, prove that they're actually interested in being there and intend to be a contributing and active member of the ward. I recently moved, well, about a year and a half ago, I moved to Virginia, and the first Sunday that I was in church, I think half a dozen women came up to me, and the first thing they said to me was, "How many children do you have?" And when I said, "None, I'm not married," they said, "Have you heard about our singles ward?" And then when it became apparent I wasn't going to go away, you know, I would get these looks every Sunday like, well, she's still here. I guess we're going to have to give her a calling. I guess we're going to have to remember her name. I wish that the church curriculum would stop making ridiculous accommodations for single women. You know, if they want to teach a lesson in Relief Society on child development or spousal relationships, I'll listen and I will learn from that. It isn't necessary for the teacher to add as a footnote that I can go home and try it on my roommate or my dog or my secretary. I don't have a roommate and my dog is 14 years old and not up to new tricks. And as for my secretary, he would not appreciate being patronized. I wish that more emphasis could be put on career education for women at church universities and in the young women's programs. I still read and see indications that BYU treats education for women as a fallback position. Too often it's promoted as that, even in the curriculum for young women. And some women, even though they may like to treat their education as a fallback position, they may never have that choice, and so I wish that they would be better prepared. I'll echo what Lisa said about more challenging programs for young women in their mutual programs. I was the girls' camp counselor, and the boys would come back and tell tales of whitewater rafting and climbing 14,000-foot peaks and dangling off of ropes. And the last year I was a girls' camp counselor, the girls learned how to do French braids. And the big debate was whether we would let them take their curling irons with them to camp. I wish that my bishop and my Relief Society president and every woman with children would not assume that I crave a baby. I may want a child, but I certainly don't want their child. I don't mind it when they share with me the joys of having children and of motherhood. Whatever happened to Mother's Day in our church? I am single, and I like going to church on Mother's Day. I don't stay home with the covers pulled over my head. And yet when I get there, it's not Mother's Day anymore. Have you noticed that? It's sort of a woman's day, and they pass out the flowers, and they make every woman over 18 stand up, and everyone in the ward knows I'm not a mother, and, you know, so they're all saying, oh, she's getting a flower. Isn't that wonderful? I have a mother. And I appreciate Mother's Day along with the rest of you. I celebrate my mother on Mother's Day, and I wish that the church was not afraid to celebrate mothers as a special class of people on Mother's Day. I am not so traumatized by my barren state that I can't serve in the nursery, nor am I so baby-hungry that I want to serve in the nursery. I would just appreciate being asked, and I think that boils down, that all of my wishes boil down to that. I would just appreciate being asked what's best for me. Thank you.
Now, Darrell, you probably already figured this out, but the thing that makes you an adult after you get married is sex. Because that's the only thing that's different from that one day to the next, so that's got to be it. I figured that out. And there's sort of an order to what's going on here. Lisa spoke about our younger girls, and Darrell spoke about single women, and I'm going to talk about young families, which is a state that I am probably recently out of but have vivid memories of. And I want you to sort of grant me a couple things. One is that our church ideal is that women should not work outside of the home. The other are two definitions. So I'm going to use these words not in any sort of pejorative sense, but as descriptions. So one is I'm going to talk about a traditional family. And a traditional family is a family where a man works and a woman stays home and manages the household and whatever children there are. Then I'm going to talk about another thing, which is a modern family. And what a modern family has is probably at least one parent and a number of children, and you can't really deduce anything about who works and who stays home or if anybody. Okay? First of all, I'm sort of reflecting. The reason I think we can take it as a given that the church has as an ideal that women should stay home, you can go back to that 1987 talk that President Benson gave that caused such an uproar. And so I have sort of wondered, or at least have figured out for myself, where I think President Benson got the idea that women shouldn't work out of the home. I think he looked back to his childhood and figured it out from there. Well, usually, okay. This means I have to stand back here. Okay. It's sort of normal for a 90-year-old white middle-class male. Most of the experience of people in that generation looking back would have had a mother at home. So, and if that was a happy thing for them, then that is an obvious ideal that we could expect them to come up with. This is an idea, this idea of women staying home. It is only been possible since the middle of the 19th century when industrialization made it so that work was outside the home. Before that, of course, everyone was home because it was a rural economy. So I figured out from that sense of the history of it all that this idea about women not working outside the home is, of course, not an eternal principle, but one that is only possible given the industrial age and what we're now in, which is the post-industrial age. It also reflects very strongly American middle-class normative values. And you will probably be aware that these are our normative values. And think about the psychological studies that have been done. Why don't we have any studies on the psychological effect of the children of men working outside the home? Because we assume that they should. Why, since it's considered normal for women to stay at home, until recently no one asked what the psychological effects might be on a woman and children being together in close proximity for 24 hours a day. What might that do to you? The reason we haven't done studies on that is that we consider that to be a normative value, so it's naturalized. We just think that's how life is. I want to suggest that that isn't how life is. That's how 1980s, actually probably like 1950s American values is. So this family system that President Benson is idealizing, when he looks back, is these are the characteristics of this system. For one thing, it never truly existed for any families other than white middle-class American families. So we're talking about a very small segment of families that this ideal was true for. It was based on legalized restrictions that enforced unequal social and economic opportunities for men and women. This kind of family maintains and reproduces those unequal opportunities. As you probably are aware, today's society no longer finds those restrictions beneficial, and at least all of the legal restrictions against female opportunities have been pretty much done away with. It also reflects the rural and agrarian nature of 19th century America. So I just would like to state that it isn't a family system that I think is good for the development of whole human beings, men, women, or children. So it isn't something that I think that we ought to be idealizing. So I would call for a leader who I think is prophetic in the dictionary sense of the word, as in visionary or able to predict the future. And I think we have had church leaders who have been very prophetic in their uses of technology, in their understanding that this American church needs to be broadened out and become a world church. But I think we have been very backward, and we do not have a prophet when it comes to family issues. It isn't very forward thinking to that. And I think what we need is help in constructing images for the modern families. The reality is that women do and will continue to work outside the home for a variety of valid reasons. I believe that all adults should prepare for paid work. There's some values in that, and I'm not devaluing what is unpaid, but that as part of the capitalist system, we value things for which one gets paid. So I'm not agreeing with those values. I'm sort of reflecting them. I don't know what the percentage of working fathers is in Utah, because that's, of course, a statistic that probably wouldn't be collected, but at least 50% of mothers in Utah work outside the home. So whatever the ideal is, the reality is, of course, not even close to the ideal. I think the eternal principle really at issue for President Benson and his real concern was our commitment to and concern for the next generation. And so my idea sort of attempts to answer the question, how can we protect and teach the children? How can we make it less traumatic for mothers to work? How can we help men develop the expressive and nurturing sides of their character? So I'm making a fairly simple proposal that I think solves the problem for adequate and affordable and safe daycare and a more reasonable sharing of child care and church responsibilities. I think we should use our church buildings as daycare centers. Structurally, if you think about it, the buildings are perfect. Keeping daycare centers in the ward means, in Utah, it means that it would be a neighborhood thing. Outside, at least, it probably would mean that you would be dealing with people you knew, so people would be caring for your children, or you would be caring for people's children when you knew the family situation. That would, of course, have its good sides and its bad sides. Co-ops could easily be organized so that men and women who can and wish to could participate in the care of their own children. Some parents who had that option could make that their paid work and be with their children at the same time. And it, of course, is much more efficient for one caregiver to deal with a number of children than for one adult to be in charge of 2.3 children, which is what the normal family has. The other idea I have comes from an experience I had when I was, you know, had like four babies under six, and didn't ever talk to anybody that was over a foot high, and you know, had all those kind of stresses. And I remember that and I was a traditional wife, so I was at home, and what normally happened was my husband would rush home. I'd feed him dinner, and he'd rush out to his stake meetings because we always lived outside of Utah. And, you know, I was limited, but I wasn't stupid. And I thought about this, and I thought, you know, I've developed all these great managerial skills in the home, and he hasn't tended the children very much. I need a change. He needs a change. He manages at work, and then he manages at church. But why don't I go manage at church, and he stays and deals with the children, because that would develop some things in him that were undeveloped. Which brings me to the issue. As long as men are the designated sex that holds the priesthood, we ought to question the nature of all those managerial church jobs. When I lived in Rochester, New York, our frantic time there in the church was during Hill Cumorah. And during the pageant time, you just spend all your time doing stuff for the pageant out the hill. And I remember, since my husband's in the elders' quorum, they came up to him and said, "We need you to get 70 priesthood holders to go park cars." And I said, wishing he would just stay home, "What is it about the priesthood that qualifies you to park cars? Could I do this?" I don't know. I think it's like how you wave the flare or something. I don't know. But anyway, the question here is, you know, have we started to think that the priesthood includes the gift of management along with the gift of discernment, or can we separate those things out? It seems to me that it would be very useful to separate them out, so that I could be developing, as a young mother strapped at home, could be developing some other skills, could be using my managerial skills, get out of the house. My husband could be developing the expressive and nurturing sides of his personality by getting to care for the children, getting to know them better, so they sort of recognize him as he flies in and out. Anyway, those are two very simple ideas, but sort of aimed at the things that face young families. And I think that these would be important, because they sort of are being realistic about watching out for the next generation, which I think is our real concern, and would help develop all of us, the children, the moms, and the dads, as whole human beings.
I too have a couple of stories, not quite as juicy as Lisa's, but and we're also sort of moving up in age, because I'm mostly going to talk about Relief Society. Recently, this summer, in our Relief Society, one of the counselors rather grudgingly announced a new program that had been instituted by our stake president, and the program was called the Bright Spot. And a few weeks later, up on the bulletin board in our Relief Society room, appeared a poster with a woman who looked very much like Aunt Jemima, with a little kerchief tied on her head. And on the poster, it says one thing that every woman is supposed to clean in her house this month. Like, it says, wash the windows. Or it says, clean out the attic. Now, the counselor who was very grudging about announcing this program is not a feminist. She's quite a conventional woman, but she was upset about the stake president saying, clean this in your house this month. And this I find as an example of a male church leader who is speaking for and to women, even in the areas that are acknowledged to be women's sphere. Now, when I mentioned this program at the Exponent Retreat earlier this summer, I got several other similar anecdotes from people. The one that was the most striking to me was the bishop who asked the Relief Society president to instruct the women in the Relief Society that they should wear slips under their dresses. Now, yeah. Especially when they're speaking on panels. Yeah. Now, when Anne told me that this panel was to be about changes we'd like to see in the church regarding women, I pulled out a list that I've been making for several years. It now It has more than 25 things so far that I'd like to see changed. Now, these are not strikingly original ideas. They're sort of a compilation of things that I've heard and thought of and that many people want. And I think by the time we get through with this panel, we will have covered most of them. And I'm probably going to cover some things that have been said already. But some of the changes that I looked at when I started to write this down were relatively major changes, like giving women the priesthood, a major revelation about Heavenly Mother, or redefining God in relation to gender, or a change in the temple endowment ceremony. Most of the others are more minor changes. Some of them are institutional, some of them attitudinal. Now, for the purposes of this panel today, from this list, I tried to identify one proposed change to focus on. And I've chosen one area, includes several of the changes, that though it could involve some institutional as well as attitudinal changes, would not fundamentally alter the existing priesthood situation nor radically threaten current church teachings about men and women and their roles. Now, I'm saying this, it's sort of my disclaimer at the beginning, because I want to make it clear that for me, the things that I'm going to outline are only preliminary to more radical changes that I think need to be made. But I do feel like even if only this much was accomplished, it would make women's experience in the church more rewarding and less frustrating. And it would bring the institutional church's practice closer to what it already preaches, that though men and women are fundamentally different, they are equal. Now, as I see it, that's what the church is always telling us. Now, I don't altogether buy that personally, but I'm going to use that as an assumption because that's what the church tells us. Men and women are different, but they're equal. So given all that, the change that I'd most like to see in the current church in relationship to women is for men to stop preempting women's voices, to quit speaking for and to women, and let women speak for themselves. Now, the two church leaders that I mentioned both felt that they had the right, even the responsibility, to speak for and direct women in even the most intimate details of their lives. Now, of course, priesthood leaders give direction to and design programs for men, too, but there's a difference because priesthood leaders are men and speak from their own experience. Presumably, they represent or at least understand a male point of view. They are men speaking to men. These same men, however, also speak to women, but women don't speak to men, as a rule, in the church. I mean, can you imagine the Relief Society president setting up a program for men to clean up their yards or their offices? Or directing them on how to wear their underwear? And in the radical situation that the Relief Society president tried to do that, can you imagine that men would do it at her suggestion? And yet, men in this church are always telling us what we should do, what we should think, what we should want, and how we should feel. I don't think I need to elaborate on that, because the examples are so numerous, and we've been hearing some of them. The one that sticks in my mind, I think I've heard it several times, but it was mentioned in the famous President Benson talk, was that all women should like housework, and if you don't, you should pray to like it. Now, and that one always has stuck with me for a long time because I don't like housework, and prayer hasn't worked so far. That's because I'm not a spiritual giant, of course. Now, these men assume that they know how women do and should feel and think and so forth. And as women in the church, we are inundated with male voices saying, "Sisters, I have a message for you." This is a direct quote from our sacrament reading speaker this week. That kind of message reinforces the difference, the sort of you, not us. I'm a priesthood holder. We are the men, you, and we have a message for you. The supposed inherent difference between men and women. But it also suggests that even though men are different, they know more about what is appropriate to women than women do themselves. Thus, women aren't given autonomy or equality even within the separatist sphere that's assigned to them, and they certainly aren't allowed a voice outside of it for the most part. Now, for instance, all but two of the lessons in the Relief Society manual this year are talks by men.
This
The male speakers are the main speakers in many women's meetings, including the general women's meeting. Decisions about our lives are made in meetings where there are no women's voices. The roles and division of labor that is practiced in the church is male-defined, and I, again, this last Sunday heard priesthood equal is the equivalent of motherhood, quoted yet again by a stake leader this Sunday. Not only are women not given autonomy within their own assigned sphere, they're often not even asked for their opinion about it. Now, these are some fairly overt ways of taking over or preempting women's voices. There are also many more subtle ways. For example, the scriptures are a notable example, but many, many of our modern-day commandments and pronouncements and much of our modern discourse is patterned on it, tend to use the male gender as universal. We talk about humankind is called mankind. We have pronouncements like man is that he might have joy. I mean, it's a grammatical convention, and it's not unique to the church, but many, many publications outside of the church are becoming more and more aware of that and are trying to avoid it. The use of male pronouns for general human experience and for in neuter situations is virtually exclusively practiced in church publications. There's stereotyping, assuming that women feel like that, women like this, women are like this, women, that sort of thing. There is equating woman with mother, using those words interchangeably. And then there's this continual thing that I... And this is for those of you who read the paper that I had just in dialogue. This I talked about this at some length. The idea of us and them, we the brethren, you the sisters. We have a message for you. This continual rhythm of us and them that opposes those terms. Now, what these language practices do is either to lump all women together as a group without distinctions, to reinforce the sense that women as a group are different from men, and by implication that group is weaker, defective, or a lot of other adjectives, or as in the case of using male words and male pronouns, to just simply write women out of existence altogether as if they weren't there. All of which reinforces women's general sense of their powerlessness and inferiority in very subtle ways that they probably could, that most women could never identify. But because it's so subtle and so pervasive, it has a very powerful effect on the way women feel about their church experience. And it came out for me. I have a very interesting ward. I love my ward, but we had the lesson recently about women in the priesthood, one of the two talks by women. And I, for most of you who attend Relief Society, that was a very controversial or power-charged lesson in most wards. The most real comment that was made in our ward, the one that seemed to come most from the heart, was from a wonderful elderly black woman who stood up and said, "Well, you know, women really are inferior. And our place is to obey men." And that's the bottom line. That's what the message is telling people. Nobody else would say it. But she was speaking what she felt to be the truth. Well, to overcome this nagging and I think pernicious sense of women's basic inferiority that still persists in the church, however subtly, I think it is critical that women have a stronger voice. Women must be heard and listened to if we are ever to achieve what I see as our overall goal for women, which is full personhood in all church settings, with women's capabilities and powers fully recognized, accepted, and utilized. Women will never even be separate but equal, as is currently preached, until their voices, their opinions, their experiences, their needs, their counsel, advice, and wisdom are sought and heard. And I mean here even very conventional women, not feminists, not people concerned about women's issues, but those women who are fully in accord with the church's teachings about women's roles. I think this church still holds much too closely to Paul's dictum that women should be silent in church.
And to overcome this, I can suggest a few specific changes. And some of these have already been mentioned, and most of them are not radical, but they're just some of the specific things I think we could do. The first thing is already begun, as we all know, to have women praying in church and speaking in meetings. And women, one of the strengths of our church is that women have spoken in meetings for many years. But I would like to, and now we have women speaking at every level. We even have a token woman or two speaking in general conference. But I would like to see much more of that. And not only more women speaking, but I'd like to see them have equal time allotments, and I'd like to see their speeches given equal weight. That they're sometimes put at the end or the beginning, that they're not always given 5 minutes sandwich or treated between two heavyweights, or that they're not treated like a youth speaker, as they often are in sacrament meetings and state conferences. I'd like to, and why not see women as a woman as the main speaker in a meeting? And how about having women speak in priesthood meeting once in a while? Priesthood meetings. We have men speak in women's meetings. Couldn't women share something with the men that might be useful to them? Second thing I'd like to see is I'd like to have women's voices heard in ward, stake, and regional decision-making councils. If not as fully voting or functioning members, at least as advisors. For example, currently there are women in correlation and welfare meetings on the ward level, but not in bishopric or PEC meetings where most of the decisions are made. Why couldn't the Relief Society president be in these meetings where the real decisions are made to give her point of view, her advice? Why couldn't the female auxiliary heads be present at high council meetings, like the president of the Young Men's Organization and the president of the Activities Committee are, because they're high council members? I think there are a number of decision-making councils in the church where women, at least in advisory positions, could be present without altering anything, without scaring anybody too much. I'd like to see more women writing lessons. I'd like to see more women's talks used. If we're going to use talks by men, let's use more talks by women's and lessons. And I say this because I think lots of the lessons are now written by women, but they're not attributed to women. So I'd like to, so that women know that women are writing the lessons that they are teaching from, especially in releases. But I think especially in young women, because again, I think that would serve as a model for women, young women. I'd like, and along the same line, I'd like to see more women quoted in all of our manuals, including the priesthood manuals. A friend of mine counted up in a series of Relief Society lessons, and there were approximately 10 quotes from men, as opposed to one for women in women's lessons, not let alone others. Now, I'm not suggesting that we rewrite the scriptures, but I do think we could be careful to orally add women when we're talking about scriptures, as many people do in practice. But I think that we should be really careful in our own present-day talking and writing that we never use male-gendered words as universal, that all printed materials from the church are carefully scrutinized for sexist language and for stereotyping. Lisa's already mentioned that, especially it's critical in the primary. I think, as somebody has been mentioned, we should send more women on missions so that their voices are being heard teaching new members and potential members. I think we need to consider calling women to more visible positions that are usually filled by men, where there's no particular need for priesthood to fill the job. And this is what Anne was talking about, partly. I, for example, really approve of many women PCDs, or public communications directors, now, which I think gives a good message to the public that we have women spokesmen for the spokespersons for the church. It's hard. And one that would be more challenging would be to reinstitute women giving blessings, at least to other women and children. And that's been talked about quite a bit. Those are just a few examples of ways in which I think women's voices could be heard more. If women do begin to be heard more, they'll develop more confidence in their right and their ability to speak. And this will be good both for them and for the organization. If women spoke with more confidence, men would begin to listen. And men would begin to realize that they may not always know what is best for women. And they might start asking more questions, questions of themselves and questions of God. And then we might see a lot of other changes. And I think one of the things that makes people, some people nervous about giving women more voice is, what would they say? And I think for the most part it wouldn't be too threatening. I don't know what most women would say. I'm not going to speak for them. I suspect that one of the first things we'd hear from all sorts of women in the church, from married women, who are often the focus of much of this discourse, is that they would like their fathers to be home more, that they would like the men not to be gone so much. And I think that's a case of the church. It would encourage the church even further to practice what they're preaching about families. A friend of mine got really upset when somebody in a church meeting was advocating that, being very generous and helpful to women, that the fathers should stay home and babysit. And she turned to me and she said, "Fathers do not babysit. He is their father. He is not a babysitter." I think that one of the other things that women might say is that we don't all like to cook, sew, and make homemade marshmallows, that we are different, and that we don't all like the same to do the same things. And I think another thing that might be heard eventually is, what is the effect of the long years of men speaking for women and telling them what to do? Hospital in our community sends out a newsletter to women, and I just want to read you a little quote in this. It says, "A growing volume of research indicates that, in simple terms, a happy mother, whether she is employed or not, enjoys better health and a more well-adjusted family than a woman who feels overwhelmed by pressure to either stay home or return to work." And I think that said a lot to me, because it said, what is destroying our families is not women going to work, it's pressure on women, outside pressure, do this, do that. That's what's tearing women up. And I think it would be an important message if some men in the church were to realize that insisting that women, all women, if possible, stay home with their children may actually be hurting families rather than helping them. Well, as it stands, Anne mentioned the question which was originally raised by Freud, I believe, what do women want? In the church is generally a rhetorical question. What is usually asked is not what do women want, but what should women want? And what I'd like to see is for that question, what do women want, to become a real question, and that women be asked for the answer without having the words taken out of their mouths by men.
Was it yesterday, Anne, that you asked me to do this?
What? No, years ago.
Years ago. One of my most outstanding qualifications for being here is that I'm very, very good friends with Mary Bradford, and she set me up for this. And it's been very interesting. I decided, well, how was I going to do this quickly and put in the 20-hour days that I've been doing at work lately? And that was to take a poll. So the structure of my talk is very loose. In fact, it reminds me of Zen. A couple of years ago, I heard someone at this conference, I think his name was Job, say, "I am Jewish, I am a Buddha, a Buddhist, becoming Buddha, I suppose, and a Mormon." And I like that. He says, "I don't see anything incongruent with those things." So I took up Zen a while ago, and I carry my Zen to go, and I'm going to share some of that with you today. But I was thinking about change, and I thought of the times in my life when I have really been restless for change. And if you can excuse this visual image, the time that I felt myself in a little tiny cement box with my head bleeding from jumping up and hitting the ceiling so often was when I really wanted a change. And sooner or later it did change. When I feel safe, when I feel sound, well-fed, exercised, loved, stimulated, entertained, warm but not flushed, cool but not frozen, when I feel powerful but not weak, when I feel vulnerable but not weak, and when I feel powerful but not vulnerable, and those kinds of different kinds of balances that sometimes put us into a very safe zone, I don't worry too much about changing, but I do worry about rotting. And so change comes about in very strange ways. It comes to rescue us, it comes to age us, it comes to make us grow. And I think that fits where my Zen's going to say about, I like George Bernard Shaw. He said he dreaded success. To have succeeded is to have finished one's business on earth. Like the male spider who's killed by the female the moment he has succeeded in his courtship. I like a state of continual becoming with a goal in front and not behind. And that's one of the reasons why I'm a Mormon today. I love the concept of eternal progression. And the change that we are in the church sometimes doesn't seem to be happening. It's slow. I think it's very slow. And sometimes that's very frustrating. But I could say amen to all of the stories that we've heard today, because none of these ideas are things that I've never considered before. None of the ideas that I haven't considered before for many, many years. Maybe 15 or 27 years, is that what? I think that I've been in the home without pay for 27 years. And so it reminds me of what Alvin Toffler said. The women's movement would never have started if women's work had not been left out of the GNP. And I think it might have been true. So I can run about saying, when I polled the people, I polled a woman and she said, we've got to do something about the fashion shows about brides and bridesmaid clothes and what to serve at weddings for beehive girls. Right, so that was one of the things. And when we had the concept of river trips and bicycle trips to Hawaii for the boys, I think we ought to look at economics again and notice that our budgets for the boys' athletic program is there, and there isn't one for the women's. I don't believe there's any money for the women's athletic program, maybe T-shirts. I think that economics has a lot to do with what we're talking about, and I would like to see some balance come forth as we've gone through the young women's ideas. In my polling from that same woman, I love her. She's one of these people that has a lot of little children. Interestingly enough, her husband just was displaced in a very important and well-paying job to one that didn't quite meet the needs of his growing family. And she said, I haven't even got a skill. I didn't finish college, let alone have a work experience to rely on. And now I have to help support the family. So can't we please talk about realistically training people? That was in my poll. So I don't know why I should reiterate any of these things, excepting that I'm last. she really felt quite sad that we have to not go along with the idea of being and try to stretch women further than they already are stretched. I think someplace along the way, women need to be let off the hook and say, hurrah, you're wonderful, and let us be, in some sense, okay, and feel okay about who we are. And I think maybe that's what we would say to each other. Is that, you know, we're not too bad.
Mary Bradford, I pulled Mary on the phone. Mary said, why in the world would you ask me when you are a single mother of five children? Surely you can think of things you'd like changed. I wanted the elders' quorum to come over and paint my house when it was peeling, but they didn't do that. And every time the bishop wanted to talk to me about my standing in the church and he wanted me to come in, I asked him, would he like to talk about painting my house or working on the plumbing? So we never talked. But I don't worry about those things because I learned those kinds of things don't bother me so much in the fact that I figured out how to get my house painted, and it was great. I worried, though, that I had to get my sons out there to paint that house, and his father was nowhere to be found. And I think that in my poll, I got the fathering bit again. There's a man influenced by the Quakers and by Joseph Campbell, now named Robert Bly. I don't know how many of you have been influenced or have picked up on him, but he's now father of the New Men's Movement. And he held a seminar called the Healing of Wounded Men. And I believe that part of our imbalance in the whole earth, is this male-female imbalance that's happening, is that our men, bless their hearts, haven't been fathered very well, even by their father. So to struggle to find a way to how to heal, I know my own father, oh, he'd be so mad. Actually, he told me he had a terrible time being a father to my only brother. And his father, he told me his father would be terribly disappointed in him. My grandfather, the judge, would not very be happy at my father who dropped out of school at age 14 because he died. His grandfather died. But I can look back a long way on my genealogy sheet and see that men have in my family have not been fathered real well, and I can't blame it exactly on because they were in callings in the church or not, but whatever it is, maybe it's just that men need to get together in priesthood meeting, I don't know where, and heal each other, love each other, and somehow get your strength back up, because what Robert Bly says is we're getting a whole nation full of wimps. And they can't blame it on the women's movement because women cannot initiate men. Men have to do it for each other. So I love to see in my poll what happened. It came from me and several other people as they would like to see some new, exciting, rejuvenating rites of passage. Maybe taking some of the ones that we have for the men as well as for the women. And really, have you ever been to a bar mitzvah or a Jewish wedding where they celebrate these lives, put them up on a chair and dance and sing? Brings up a new one. I'd like to see dance in our worship services. I love to have dance in sacrament meeting, but I am going to have dance at my funeral. And my father may too, because he will not talk about death and he won't tell me what he wants at his funeral, so I may just arrange it. I think that as my poll goes on, did I get Mary Bradford wanted me to say that what she felt was very important for us to not let go by the way was our, not just our personal histories in our journals, but our ward histories, and that the histories are accessible in a way that we learn from them and use them, maybe in our newsletters, maybe oral histories. I'd like to see something. I think the richness of the oral histories that we have in the living people, our oracles, our crones, our wise men that are among us, that we are losing what they really have to offer us in the way of wisdom right next door to us, right in our own wards. And this could be accomplished by writing it down and sharing it through the wards, and then preserving it in history that goes along. And I am told that we are told not to keep our histories in our wards anymore, so I think that's a sad let go of. I had somebody tell me that they wished that the church would make Intermountain Healthcare take off LDS from their church, from their hospital, and stop pushing the penny parade under the auspices, because they didn't think that Primary Children's Penny should help pay for Scott Parker's private airplane. And so I thought that was a fairly risky hope, that private enterprise gets to go on a big way and a nonprofit status on the back of a long ago partnership with the Mormon Church. And economics seems to come up quite a bit. I'd like to see somehow when we relate to the poor, that we don't have to make a judgment on them, on their worthiness, or on the possibility that they might be professional panhandlers or professional poor people. I think that it would be just wonderful to go back to what Christ said about the poor will always be with us, and we don't have to worry about judging them. I think that the whole issue is missed when we are the ones that are being judged, and it isn't the poor at all, because I think the poor is something people are changing, and it's us. And I think that if we don't examine our policies in the church along that line, we are going to be not getting the growth we're supposed to in this segment. I don't know that we're going to get too much more direction until we got the direction that we've got right. So I really would love to see that policy of having to interview everyone for their worthiness about receiving help. I have a friend that I thought was one of the most spiritual giants in the world I'd ever met. When I became active in the church again, she was my visiting teaching companion, and a more spiritual person I've never seen. She left the church recently after she was asked to talk about black women's history or position, and she had to sit down and understand that nobody, she hadn't heard anybody stand from the pulpit and talk about the racial bigotry that is still in our church, and that please couldn't somebody just stand over the pulpit and say, would you please drop your racial bigotry? Not subtly, but overtly deal with these kinds of things, because her children, her grandchildren were being mistreated in primary and nobody would address it. And she said, I can take the prejudice myself, but I can't submit my grandchildren to this. And until the leaders will put black men on the stands on TV and in the general authorities and talk in a way that makes everybody stretch to overcome what is innate in our society, I can't come anymore. And it broke my heart, because I loved Clara so much and she had given me so much strength. So I would love to see us work towards these just Christ-like issues in a stronger way. I wonder if I ever got any more on the notes. Were profuse, and they were covered so well by everyone else. Oh, the very first person that I ever asked about change in the church was Helen Stark. You may all know Helen Conlon Stark. And I mean, practically, Helen, what can we do for women and about what is going on? And she said, we have to recognize Heavenly Mother and talk about her more and understand her role more and ask Heavenly Mother and Heavenly Father more about this feminine view. And I was told that was not a very practical thing to do, to talk about. But Helen maintains that is the most practical thing that we can actually do, is be praying more about and to our Heavenly Mother in public and in our homes. And if we do this, we will be enlightened by them. In this Relief Society a lesson that we had about the priesthood, I raised my hand and threw out the old thing we've been talking about at Exponent for 100 years. Well, you know, those traits about the Holy Ghost seem awfully feminine. Could the Holy Ghost happen to be Mother? And I was quickly dismissed, but a sweet old woman came up to me after, and she said, do you know what Elohim means? And I said, yes, but how come nobody else knows? And she said, well, you know Elohim means male and female gods, but the rest of the world isn't ready for that, so we can't talk about it. And I said, I think it's time. I think it's time we talk about it. And it's nothing new in our gospel to understand that celestial progression and those goals are male-female balanced. And why we aren't striving towards having a husband-wife bishop, I don't know. I'd like to see that. I'd love to have a husband-wife bishop. And I have a sex part of mine too, because I have I can't say that I've always been single, and I've always wanted to have this place to stand up here and say, I'm sorry, Jean England, but I'd love polygamy to come back. And, about the only people I ever know who'd like to see polygamy come back are men and single women. So I don't know. I did have some married women and some single women who really could care less, but I kind of think the idea is still viable, and hate to be throwing it out.
Okay, sit down.
It's because Anne doesn't think sex is fun anymore. Oh, Mother's Day. Oh, that was a good one. Mother's Day is to celebrate your mother, and I think the minute that I dropped my expectations on Mother's Day of being celebrated was the Mother's Day that I had, a great Mother's Day. And going to church and worrying about being lauded because you have five children and they've all had the flu, and I could tell you the stories to break your hearts about being a mother. But when I turned that around to celebrate my own mother, I had a great Mother's Day. And I have had a lot of Mother's Day none of my children remembered too much about it, and I've made some terrible mistakes on Mother's Day because of that rejection that I set myself up for. So I love to see us all just really cherish our mothers and not have to worry about being cherished, and maybe it'll turn around and get us. maybe it won't, but if we live long enough, it might. I had somebody tell me that they thought the meeting period, our long period with the sacrament meeting, was really, really unkind to children. And somebody says it's also unkind to old women with urinary problems and and old men. I don't know about all the rest of us, but that's what I was told. I thought it was kind of significant. Besides the preschools in our buildings, the use of our buildings during the week, I would also like to see maybe more something done with our senior citizens in those spaces. I think a lot of use could be done with our spaces, even rehearsals for dance companies or nonprofit organizations that are struggling and that are worthwhile, to integrate our building use. And so I can see the nervousness now mounting about how long I'm taking, so I'm not going to say anymore. And I am going to go with the concept of not worrying about structure, the beginning, the middle, and the end, and all of those sorts of things, and read you a poem, another part of Zen to go. It's sometimes you reach a point of being, oh no, wait, I got the wrong one. It would have been good, but... Mountains should be climbed with as little effort as possible and without desire. The reality of your own nature should determine the speed. If you become restless, speed up. If you become winded, slow down. You climb the mountain in an equilibrium between restlessness and exhaustion. And then when you're no longer thinking ahead, each footstep isn't just a means to an end, but a unique event in itself.
It's close to the end of time, so I won't try to hold you here. You've been a very attentive audience. Do we want to go? Do we want to stay? Did you want to say one thing?
Think that it would be totally ridiculous to do what we would tell them.
would that naive and caring counselor actually implement that ridiculous program? Let's stop doing dumb things with the kids.
Yeah. I'd like to respond to that because I think you're absolutely right. But the problem is that it's been going on for such a long time, and I'm talking centuries, millennia here, that most women, I mean, most of the women who are here could stop. But most of the women who aren't here wouldn't think of stopping. And that's why I think it's so important that if we institutionally set it up so that women have more voice, more opportunity to speak, then women will begin to develop the confidence to be able to speak. But there are many women in the church today who don't want to speak. I mean, how many times have you heard, "I don't want the priesthood. I don't want to be a bishop. I don't want to do those things." I mean, there are thousands and thousands of women who don't want to and don't think they can do it. What you're saying is absolutely right, but I think we've got to have some steps to get women there. And some of those steps have got to be institutional, because there are many, many women in this church that don't have the courage to make changes and may not even realize that they want changes until they are given a chance.
Or I think people that believe what we've been taught about authority, so it's not even that they don't have the courage, it's that we would not believe we should do that sort of thing. Yeah, it's your socialization. I don't think you cannot take that into account.
Besides that, if you stop doing all of the stupid things they tell you, you might stop coming, and then that would be a cop-out.
Well, it's an option.
It is an option, that's true. I've done both.
Is there any other comment back there?
I think that's especially true for the youth. I'm speaking without much authority here, but my impression is that most of the other churches that I know of, the youth are not split. They meet together in their youth groups. But we're, again, so hung up with sex that we want to always keep things separate. And that's why I made that one disclaimer, is that because I don't think... I mean, the Supreme Court said eventually that separate but equal is not possible.
Yeah.
As long as people are separate, they are not equal. At least it's a terribly difficult thing to realize. And I absolutely agree with you. That's one of the other changes on my list that I had. There was one, I think we should drop the word mothering and use parenting. And that our young people should meet together. We split them up starting when they're age 10, don't we? Or is it 9? Well, and they're split for the rest of their lives.
Moreover, as you pointed out, the minute joint activities are thought of that involve more than just, you know, an hour on Wednesday night, there can. In our ward, we began having just one Sunday a month where the young men and the young women had a joint lesson, and that was like within 2 months it was out of there, gone.
How do you explain that?
I think that it comes to sex. I think it comes down to the problem of female desire. I mean, when Doris proposed things like having women in PEC meeting, I can think immediately outside of Utah that would involve maybe possibly...
Traveling together,
yes.
And my experience in Texas was I had to travel 2 hours to stake meetings across roads. No one else traveled alone so that those men could handle their desires.
It was awful.
Blessings are an interesting ordinance, and what really has to happen for the church records, as I understand it, is just the naming. So we have always had our family blessings, my siblings and I, at home. And the last one that my brother had, he gave the baby a blessing in a circle of men, and then we women blessed the baby and passed it around and each prayed over it, and there were some different languages going on there, but it was a very lovely experience, and I really appreciated the opportunity to have to get myself together to be able to pray over this new child in our family. So what really needs to happen in sacrament meetings is the giving of the name. The blessings, of course, can happen in a private setting. Yeah, that would be... She's just mentioning that when we pray for the leaders of the church, it would be nice to pray for both the male and female leaders.
That reminds me, on Tuesday I was in the Church History Museum, and there's a beautiful portrait of Bathsheba Smith, who was one of the early presidents of the Relief Society. And there's the little thing down in the corner that talks about the artist. And whoever had written this little blurb said, this is considered to be one of the finest portraits ever painted of a church leader. And I stopped at that and looked at it, and I thought, did they put this by the wrong painting? Church leader. I was so euphoric. I thought, Bathsheba Smith, a church leader. Then I went around the corner, and there's this great picture of women. It's a painting, contemporary painting of women canning, older women, heavy set, you know, working over the peaches or something. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful painting. And the blurb down in the corner said, not prettified. The artist showed these women as they really are. And I thought, why would they be prettified? So, I mean, maybe the same person did both blurbs and they're really schizoid. I don't know. But I was encouraged by Bathsheba Smith being a leader of the church.
Thank you. Okay. Do you have any other comments? Right there? Thank you.
However, men still park the cars at the local market.
Do they? We moved. Was there another comment back there?
I have a question for you. How do you reconcile? Well, I assume you're an active member of the church.
Yes.
How do you reconcile your personal knowledge of the difference between Ezra Duckman's opinion and his calling of the prophet with the fact that he's using his calling of the prophet to promote?
Do you want me to answer that, or my guess is that you have an answer for that?
No.
Oh. When that talk was given, I thought it was very interesting. I had already come to the time in my life where I decided to get a PhD, plan on working for the rest of my life. I mean, working for paid labor, though it'll be low paid for the rest of my life. And so his talk was not, it was only a milestone for me to see that it had no effect on me. I had really already sort of decided the authority issues about who got to decide what I ought to be doing. So that was not really an issue for me. I noticed, though, for my sister and others, I never actually heard the talk, and heard it in priesthood meeting a couple of years later, just out of curiosity. But my sister and others were very upset by it, and I could see by the amount of foment and people discussing it, I sort of took it as a sign of where they were in their lives, of how, and it seems to